Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in Paper 94, Section 9, which is Old Single Column, page 1037. Okay, before we get going, thought I'd just read that next to the last little paragraph in section 8, just to remind you how they, one of the ways they were summing up the basic formation of Buddhism, before we get into its dissemination, as you see here in section 9. So they said, the great truth of Siddhartha's teaching was his proclamation of a universe of absolute justice. He taught the best godless philosophy ever invented by mortal man. It was the ideal humanism, and most effectively removed all grounds for superstition, magical rituals, and fear of ghosts or demons. So we've got that element that they're stressing at the end, a very key element. You'll see that come back around again as it starts to spread out to other locations. He really was effective at least putting a first layer of topsoil over those very foundational elements of evolutionary religion, like superstition and magic, and the whole ghost cult framework, in order to achieve that, he had to push on it so hard that he ended up depersonalizing the object of the religious effort. But it's a step. It's not unlike the individual journey that each of us has to make as you move up the levels of meaning. You start out with a very individuality conscious and hence anthropomorphic sense of things. You move up a little bit, basically from the first to the second level of meaning. You move up a little bit, and you get that first recognition of the continuumness of unity, where within which all individuality melts away in this glorious infinite bliss. But you have to then move up beyond that and find a new way to get a hold of what seems to have no handles, right? From your material individuality perspective, right? That unity, there's no way to get your hands on it, to grasp it and ball it up into some sort of individuality. But you bring in your faith grasp, you bring in that spiritual gripping mechanism, and you can take a hold of that and begin to develop an individualized relationship to spirit. Okay. So, and see, in many ways, I mean, when they say he taught the best godless philosophy, they're saying that he definitely got up there above where you're just kind of ending up with the gray-bearded magic man sort of notion of God. He got above that. And it was reasonably pregnant, more pregnant with the ability to kind of re-grip it than, say when in pure Brahmanism, a pure Brahmanism sort of a setting. But he didn't. It remained relatively diffused. at least to begin with. You know, when they say it was the ideal humanism, we so often, you know, speak of humanism in very negative terms. You know, they're pointing out here, it's not in some sense absolutely bad or negative. It can have its place in an evolutionary process. But, you know, when we speak of it negatively, it's because we have gone forward into a budding relationship with the real God, and to go back to that, you know, a human exaltation gives you an exaltation that's not like the more primitive, innocent one. Right? It you know, you end up transferring that budding God recognition onto you, you know, onto humanity. You know, it becomes very much a negativism at that point. You know, that's something that's been taken to extreme and has become bad, okay, to have it in that mode. You know, so when they're speaking about humanism, you know, when they're talking about, say, secular totalitarianism or something like that, okay, you know, that's, you know, it's a negative thing. It's a negative thing right now for the Western world to be falling back into humanism, because it isn't really falling back. It's taking it forward in a very self-righteous way. But we want to see, you know, in what sense they, you know, they mean it was, you know, kind of so pregnant with potential, the best godless philosophy. We want to see how that plays out as the centuries roll forward. You know, what is that, you know, that positive potential that they're hinting at there?
So does that mean if you took their philosophy and added God to it, they might have something?
Right, yeah.
To me, when I read it,
yeah,
because it looked to me like, you know, this is an opportunity of how you can approach the Buddhist philosophy just by adding, you know, mm-hmm. the God part. And the next sentence of the first mm-hmm. sentence of the next paragraph
mm-hmm.
also is quite telling, I think, when you're thinking about the whole, you know, how would you have a gospel that doesn't produce, you know, social service or
something? Yeah, and we'll get into that bit about...
It just doesn't seem like it would be... Because the Buddhist people I know are very... You know, socially service,
right, right,
in an unselfish way,
right, right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah, and see, we're definitely, yeah, we'll get into that right away in this next section. To, you know, they'll pick up on that, as he's pointing out for everyone. You know, that first sentence in the final paragraph of that section about, you know, that it did not produce a religion of unselfish social service. It didn't initially produce one. Okay, and they'll talk about how that does come into play eventually. The other thing, you know, to notice in that paragraph I read, that first sentence, the great truth, you know, we'll see that some more, you know, them kind of directly challenging you to not judge it just on its factual surface, right, but to recognize how there's a subtle relationship to eternity there in a holistic way. That gives it a potential beyond its appearance, you know, very much beyond its appearance.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So that's the that's where we left things. You know, you can, you know, glance back at the rest of section 8 there and see how, you know, remind yourself that we went through some of the basic elements of the Eightfold Path and such, the moral commandments, and so you've got this initial approach, set of concepts, kind of basic motivation coming from Gautama. Now, what do his you know, disciples and the missionaries go out and do with that? Let's see how that story plays out here.
Section 9, the spread of Buddhism. Buddhism prospered because it offered salvation through belief in the Buddha, the Enlightened One. It was more representative of the Melchizedek truths than any other religious system to be found throughout Eastern Asia. But Buddhism did not become widespread as a religion until it was espoused in self-protection by the low-caste monarch Asoka, who, next to Akhenaten in Egypt, was one of the most remarkable civil rulers between Melchizedek and Michael. Asoka built a great Indian empire through the propaganda of his Buddhist missionaries. During a period of 25 years, he trained and sent forth more than 17,000 missionaries to the farthest frontiers of all the known world. In one generation, he made Buddhism the dominant religion of one half the world. It soon became established in Tibet, Kashmir, Ceylon, Burma, Java, Siam, Korea, China, and Japan. And generally speaking, it was a religion vastly superior to those which it supplanted or upstepped.
Okay, many things there in that opening salvo. Okay, so note that first statement. Buddhism prospered because it offered salvation, and kind of you can just go dot, dot, dot after that, right? As we've talked about, I mean, that's what most people are looking for, some salvation scheme. You know, we all start with a lot of self-interest, you know, relative to religious concepts. You know, so what about me and my salvation? And, you know, and that's why it's so difficult, it's so unnatural to think post-Pentecost, right? You know, 2,000 years have rolled by and no one is really thinking in a different mode yet. Everyone is still thinking about their salvation. It's like, no, the salvation thing is off the table now. That's been taken care of.
But didn't they know that?
You can take your salvation for granted.
Did you know that yourself before this book you read?
Of course not.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah, of course I didn't know that. Because, you know, who would have taught me that? Right? You know, someone in the ghost cult that's still clamoring for their salvation? Not likely. Right? Doesn't matter what religious tradition you're from. Right?
Chris, what is salvation?
Well, you see, that's the whole question. You know, exactly, precisely, what do you mean about this saving? You know, what are you being saved from? And into what transcendent domain? You know, is your salvation? You know, all those technical issues depend upon the scheme. Are you being saved from suffering? You know, are you being saved from sin? What are you being saved from? But just, you know, remember why that is where everyone is. Some notion of seeking salvation, as they talked about in the ghost cult, you know, development of evolutionary religion. The almost 100% approach that everyone has always taken is based upon not gift, but debt, right? That you're born in debt in some way, and you need to be saved from this, this hole, this deficit that you are born into, right? You somehow need to get out of that, you know, whether it's a hole of suffering, you know, that you were born into, a pit of suffering, or whatever it is, you know? If you profess that you're by nature sinful and unclean, or whatever you think that your initial debt state is, you know, you believe you need to figure out some scheme to get out of that, to be saved from that.
Atonement.
Right, and atonement eventually, you know, in many religions is, you know, comes into play, right?
So if you add the word eternal before salvation, that also for a lot of people means that, you know, there's life after death. There's continuing on, that you're saved from, you know, either damnation or just total destruction or whatever, from an eternal basis. And I think a lot of that in people's back of people's minds is, you know, they talk about salvation in so many ways here, and Jesus talked about it as one of the, you know, main things that the saving grace, etc. But I mean, for me anyway, it's more of a feeling of the fact that you know, God's got my back no matter what, and I have an eternal soul, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm saved, as they say. You ever see that movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Mm-hmm. I'm saved. Save me from all my sins. And for what he was saying a minute ago, so many people are taught that of the concept of original sin, and that you're born with sin, you know, from the Adam and Eve situation in many religions, that I think that that's what they're speaking to when I read it anyway.
Yeah. Now, you've got this whole evolutionary religion historical context that we've both been speaking to, but there's an element of truth to it, okay, that's been unrecognized until the opportunity to recognize it was presented to us in the fifth epical revelation. There is a literal need for quote-unquote being saved. You know, if you're going to be an individual that exists forever, you need to have a body, you need to have a nature that, you know, is indelible, that doesn't unravel, right? Matter is not going to get you there. Not even Marantia substance is going to work, because that's an artificial substance that requires someone, some being, to be holding Marantia substance together for your sake. Right? Matter holds itself together, as it were, you know, sort of seated upon the Isle of Paradise. But Marantia, you know, doesn't have there isn't an absolute of Marantia, right? So it doesn't hold itself together. I mean, that's an artificial construct of substance. So that's not going to work for some sort of self-contained form. So at some point, you're going to need to be saved in a substance, you know, that's eternal. You're going to be spiritized. You're going to have a body that is, you know, effectively spirit substance, right? So that it doesn't unravel, right? And just let me complete the thought here. Right? And so when you're reading in the Revelation and they tell you about your ascension scheme, you know, they tell you that you move up an initial hierarchy in the local part of the, you know, in our case of the Milky Way galaxy, in this local region, you're moving up a hierarchy, and eventually you get to the headquarters world of what's called the local universe, the local wholeness, you know, that we exist in. And they need to coin a name, you know, that's basically an English-like name for the capital, you know, that local universe headquarters. What do they name it? Salvington. Okay? Why do they call it Saved Kind Town? Salvington. Right? Because you leave there, leaving behind a Marantia body that you've had all the way up to the local universe. You leave there as what they call a first stage spirit, right? You are spiritized. You are literally saved, right? Your mindful self is now seated upon, you know, a body nature that is not going to unravel on you or whatever, okay? You've been saved. See, there's a literalness to that. And, I mean, to recognize that because that's literally something that has to happen, and we're utterly ignorant of it, but that comes down super consciously into our mind, that fact, that filters down as a vague little shadow in our consciousness, where we kind of know we need to be saved, but we're thinking in very immediate material terms and stuff. It's like, I need to be saved from the grave, you know, of mortal death or something like this. Right? That's why every planet comes up with all kinds of notions of salvation. The word has been put in your head, but you don't know what to apply it to.
So, and the word is like born again.
Mm-hmm.
So born again from spirit. So
yeah.
born again from the soil, go back to the dust.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're born into spirit, second birth.
Right. The born again is where you're beginning this relationship more directly to that eventual literal having a spirit body. You have a mindful self. Mind is an energy that is synchronized with matter on one end and spirit substance on the other end. And so your consciousness within that mind could be founded, based, predicated on either endpoint. Is matter the foundation for your basic consciousness, or is spirit substance the basis for your consciousness? When spirit becomes the basis instead of matter, you've been born again, right? You're born and naturally seated upon that material foundation. You for those who've listened to me a long time, one of the ways I talk about that is you're born with your feet planted on time. It's not just material, but it's a temporal domain, your feet are planted on. When you're born again, you plant your feet on spirit and in eternity. So how do you approach your day-to-day life? Do you approach it from the non-objective vantage point of time, right? Caught up in the minutiae, not able to see the forest for the trees? Or do you approach your day-to-day life from an objective vantage point, from the top down, from eternity? You stand on eternity and look down upon time and engage it, the minutiae that time demands, with your fingers, which can do minute work. Right? Your toes are of limited use for detailed work, right? You should plant your feet in eternity. They're great for helping with balance. But you need your fingers to handle the details of time. And so that's another way of thinking about being really born again. Now, a lot of people, we have this concept, and then people say, born again, that sounds like a great thing. What does that mean? I think it means for prior part of my life, I was very just matter of fact about things. Now I'm very emotional about everything. I've been born again. You can rationalize this in lots of ways, right? Maybe, you could decide that when you kind of plant your feet on the level of the feelings, the second level of meaning, instead of the first level of meaning, the level of the flesh, right, that makes you born again. Okay, but not really. Don't accept no substitutes, right, for eternity. No delusional substitute, right? You'll know when your feet are planted on eternity because, behold, all things will be becoming new.
Once you're
right?
Born again.
Right? you will literally have a completely different relationship to the day-to-day affairs. Right? You will think that having enduring peace is something besides a pleasant, wishful thought. You'll know it, right? You will stand unmoved, right? Eternity is not just a lot of time. It's not time at all, right? It's apart from time. There's nothing, no matter how great in time, that has one iota of influence on eternity. There isn't anything in time that can move you if you stand on eternity. Right? So, you'll know when you're there. Accept no substitute. Don't fool yourself by saying, I experienced enduring peace one time. No, you didn't. Right? By definition, right? Enduring peace, you know, doesn't go away.
Okay. Is that why it's enduring?
Yes, slightly.
But didn't Jesus have a good conversation with Nicodemus about this? When he talked about...
Mm-hmm.
So, I have a mind fart, excuse me. The concept of on paper 142, I know exactly where it is, I just can't remember exactly what it said. Does anybody know where I'm going with
this? No, I know. I'm looking for where you're going. Okay, you can look it up.
That's
because, you know, that's one of the things that Jesus said. I mean, he said, you know, not unlike what I was just saying, right? Okay, just one second. And his followers kind of sort of remembered that, right? And it got fed into Christianity, right? But it's not a Christian thing. It's a reality thing, right? I mean, if anything, you have to overcome the foolish notions in Christianity to get to the real fact of being born again. You know, and not accept, again, some feelingful, delusional substitute that some Christian might, you know, say is being born again. You know, there's a real physics to being born again. It's not something, you know, that, you know, has anything to do with belief. Right? It just is. Right? What's your basis of perspective? Do you approach everything from the time viewpoint or from the eternity viewpoint? Right? And as it seems like, it's like, well, how could I possibly really approach things from the eternity viewpoint? Well, in and of yourself, as a blob of protoplasm, you can't, of course, by grace alone. Right? You've been given by grace an initial relationship to eternity that you can choose to stand on. Right? That the eternity relative to the finite, you can understand as supremacy. You've been given that initial thread, that initial supreme thread of encirclement in the Holy Spirit. That is a relationship to eternity that's just there. Right? It's a long time before you literally will stand on the Isle of Paradise and literally step out of time and into eternity, you know, and then do some things there and then go back out into time again. Right? That's a long ways, you know, down the road. Right? But that eternity's been brought down to you, a little measure of it by grace, right? So that you can stand on it long before you can plant your feet in your residence on the Isle of Paradise. Yeah. So you got.
I do. This. I think this answer is pretty good. So Jesus answered Nicodemus, "Verily, verily, I say to you, Nicodemus, except a man be born from above, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Then replied Nicodemus, "But how can a man be born again when he is old? He can't enter a second time into his mother's womb to be born."
But his mother is dead.
Yeah, especially if his mother is dead.
Jesus said, "Nevertheless, I declare to you, except a man be born of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. But you should not marvel that I say you must be born from above. When the wind blows, you hear the rustle of the leaves, but you do not see the wind, whence it comes or whither it goes. And so it is with everyone born of the Spirit. With the eyes of the flesh, you can behold the manifestations of the Spirit, but you cannot actually discern the Spirit." Nicodemus replied, "But I do not understand. How can that be?" Said Jesus, "Can it be that you are a teacher in Israel and yet ignorant of all this? It becomes then the duty of those who know about the realities of the Spirit to reveal these things to those who discern only the manifestations of the material world. But will you believe us if we tell you of the heavenly truths? Do you have the courage, Nicodemus, to believe in one who has descended from heaven even the Son of Man. And Nicodemus said, But how can I begin to lay hold of this upon the Spirit, which is to remake me in preparation for entering into the kingdom? And Jesus answered, Already does the Spirit of the Father in heaven indwell you, and you would be led by the Spirit from above. Very soon, if you would be led, very soon would you begin to see with the eyes of the Spirit, as you were saying, mm-hmm. and then by the wholehearted choice of Spirit guidance, would you be born of the Spirit, since your only purpose in living would be to do the will of your Father who is in heaven. And so, finding yourself born of the Spirit and happily in the kingdom of God, you would begin to bear in your daily life the abundant fruits of the Spirit. Just kind of give you a...
Right, and see, and I mean, again, those, you know, because he said things like that, and it was kind of sort of remembered by his apostles and disciples, and the kind of the gist of it got into the New Testament. Christians play with this idea, but you see, there's one big problem. No one knows the definition of the word Spirit. So when you say born of the Spirit, people are free to interpret in whatever frame they, you know, rationalize that word. The run-of-the-mill Christian isn't being literal about the Latin word spirit. He's not thinking literally breath, okay? But what Christian is thinking of? Spirit is another literal substance in the external world that you can build buildings out of, like granite. Okay, no Christian is thinking that. And that's what Jesus is referring to, right? Is literally, see, right now, you know, when I start up, my brain, right, is this seat. My brain is made out of matter. My brain is my seat for my mind. My mind is seated upon that. And all my consciousness is predicated on the framing of my mind by my genetics, by my biologic nature. But I can rotate that 180 degrees. There's another substance outside of my mind besides matter, spirit substance. Okay? And my mind on the other end is attuned to that. I can stand on that. And unlike the matter end, I have a personality, a free will gripper for spirit and how it relates to my mind. It's in my free will hands how spirit substance outside of my mind frames my mind. I have no free will control over my genetics and how it frames my mind down at the bottom end. Right? So to be born of the Spirit, right, to base that on it, you know, is to discover your genuine liberty. Right? And the truth that comes with that, you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. See, you're free to reframe your mind. If your genetics is poor, and you've had to live in the context of an ill-framed mind, there's good news. You have the potential to reframe things, right? Yeah, you can't change your genetics, but you can hang out in the part of your mind that's closer to the Spirit foundation, right? And dwell there mostly, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's see you first.
I was first.
Yeah, let's there you go.
Two of the words that were in the quote was wholehearted choice, and you would begin to. So if you're born of the Spirit, you can be at a beginning and beginning to, and the wholehearted choice, of course. So those stuck out because in this evolution that we're in right now, we can only begin to do some of this.
Yes, exactly.
It can't be like a black and white, it's all this
no.
or none. So
yeah, like I said before, right? I mean, born of the Spirit is the beginning. Eventually leaving the local universe as a first stage spirit is the end of that beginning process. And that's a long time away, right?
Yes. Contrary to what I hear from you and what I heard from after your friend, what the gentleman read, John read, was quite contrary to this. In other words, there was no word of you have the choice to choose, or you're in the control, or you have the freedom to choose.
Well, in that immediate context. In that immediate context.
So in other words, what we read, the word spirit was like the breath, like air, and then he gave the analogy of it is like the wind that nobody knows when it comes. So this is the wind, that this is the spirit that will set us free and empty, born again, that nobody knows. Hence it comes from and hence it goes. It's like the wind. It's like that analogy that also comes in.
Right, but just remembering that he was drawing an analogy, just like parables for analogies. Parables was where he used the physics of matter to help you to recognize the physics of spirit substance, which, like he said, you can't kick or see or poke or lick or take. That's why the initial, as humans recognize there was something. Remember, initially, and still today, humans haven't separated spirit from mind, but they have tried to separate something from body. And they knew it was something intangible, this not body thing that they recognized existed. And so, but they couldn't think literally beyond matter, so humans have always tried to figure out the most rarefied, tenuous, material thing that they've experienced. And they call that, in some way or another, mind or spirit, right? Breath. Right, that was the initial concept, that must be, your not body thing. You're not, or as far from tangibly material thing as possible, part of you. Right, they were very literal about it. Okay, Jesus is saying, between the lines, he's reminding the scholar who's hearing him, right, that you can think about how humans initially tried to rationalize spirit, right, with the wind or breath. Right, we're going to read about that when we get to Benton Butte Buddhism here shortly. You can think about that. It's like, okay, but not literally is that spirit, but think like that, that it's something that you just can't reach over and pick it up like I can this cup, right? It's a little bit hard to grab wind in your hand, and hit someone with it like a snowball, right? And so, there's kind of the notion is kind of there, right? The essence of it, even if it isn't the substance of it. Right. So that's, but anyway, to get back to Buddhism here, notice that, we just couldn't control ourselves for half an hour there. You say the word salvation and everyone goes bananas.
Cheerful.
That makes my point, right, of what I was saying up front. There are certain things that humans, they're just like catnip, right? You can't, they're just irresistible. And you start churning and you want to preach about them and you want to rationalize it and figure it out. It's a very compelling thing. And that's why, because it's so naturally like that, even, when Jesus was trying to tell everyone that when I leave, we're going to set up a situation where you don't have to worry about that anymore. Everyone is going to be saved from this life. They're going to make it to the next life by grace. Everyone is going to get a soul by grace, because everyone's going to get a thought adjuster by grace. And not only that, you're going to get the Spirit of Truth. If you decide to do something besides being a mere child of God, that'll give you a booster shot relative to all this spirit stuff. Okay. But it's just very difficult. It's like, I don't know. My fear-based animal mind is still pretty afraid of death, and am I really going to survive? Are you sure I don't have to do something? Isn't there a ritual I have to perform or something, right? Can I really just take it for granted and move on?
Yeah, I've got you.
Okay.
You better do what I tell you.
Anyway, right. So, not surprisingly, Buddhism prospered because it offered salvation, dot, 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 right? See, like I said. Right. I mean,
You speak about this guy Ahsoka for a minute.
So I haven't gotten to the rest of the paragraph yet. We got this whole giant paragraph, and we spent half an hour on one sentence. Okay. So, but I want to do the first sentence first. The second sentence first here. It was more representative of the Melchizedek truths than any other religious system to be found throughout Eastern Asia. Told you we'd get to that truth again, right? Right there, second sentence. Right? And you're going, wait a minute, it's godless? It's basically humanism, like they said, and stuff? What do you mean this is more representative of the Melchizedek truths? What about you know, Lao Tzu? There's A or something. It's not facts, okay? Factually, it's got serious issues with what, you know, relative to what Melchizedek was trying to teach people. But in truth, it's ripe, right? It has lots of potential. Because like I said, it most effectively, without going just totally into fuzz land, got up into some relationship with unity consciousness, so that you had your nature given, if you will, that in that sense, God given relationship to individuality. You have this initial relationship to unity. You have an initial material consciousness and an initial spiritual consciousness that you can put together and get a budding cosmic consciousness, right? And start moving towards that new individual above, that cosmic citizen that's going to synchronize with the cosmos, okay? It's ripe with potential, right? Because it got some of the unity without completely fuzzing out in it, right? Yeah, well, I mean, you know, individuality doesn't have to be, you know, merely, you know, introspective, nasal gazing. You know, but just the fact that, you know, you're this blob of protoplasm, you know, that you can put clothes around, that's individuated. You know, how can you put clothes around something that has no boundaries, right? That's just this infinite continuumness, right? I mean, you have a very immediate sense of things. The cup is there and not there, right? There's an individuality to that cup. It has a locality to it. And all of that is you know, you just get automatically that relationship to individuality. But to recognize that there's another fact that, you know, in a sense is the opposite of that, unity, continuumness. You know, that you have to discover. Now, can you see them as something besides oil and water? Can you see how there's a transcendent way to put the two together? Right?
Nirvana is also translated as salvation, which is enlightenment.
Of course, yes. Okay, so then it goes on. Anyway, he said, you know, but Buddhism did not become widespread until the thing that John is wanting to talk about. What about this Ahsoka guy? Right. So you have, you know, in the 3rd century BC, you know, same century as you had the first emperor in China. You know, so you have this very significant, you know, ruler in India as well in the 3rd century BC. You know, so in that immediately Hellenistic times, you know, post Alexander the Great times. You know, he recognizes this is what he's looking for, right? He can use this as a way of bringing a vast number of hodgepodge peoples together, all under one big umbrella with his name on it. Okay, you know, he'll put the Buddha's name on it, but it's really, you know, it's got his name on it, right? Right, and so so he started, you know, launches this, and you know, just look at how you know, Alexander-like this guy is, right? I mean, you got a lot of people that are really inspired by Alexander, if nothing else. See, and immediately post Alexander, it's like, well, if he can go to the, you know, ends of the earth and kind of bring everything all together, I want to do that too. So Ahsoka sets out, and you know, more than 17,000 missionaries go from one end to the other, not unlike the Melchizedek missionaries did. Right? Yeah. You know, eventually you've got, you know, some guy in Norway looking at his little Buddha statue, contemplating if maybe this is the real God and not Thor. Right? I mean, it goes everywhere. you know, and just, you know, during a period of 25 years, you know, just one short generation, he changes in, you know, definitely the entire, you know, eastern part of, you know, of that hemisphere.
They were mostly walking, right?
Yeah, of course.
No horses.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, horses are not as prevalent, you know, as in, you know, later times. I mean,
the farthest of all known world at that time, would that include Norway, for example?
Yeah, like I said.
India, would that be that?
Yeah, like I said. Yeah, we're talking from Japan to, you know, to England again, you know, I mean, just like with the Melchizedek missionaries. Yeah, so over the whole span, like I said, I'm not just making that up. I mean, you know, there's, you know, Buddhist missionaries got all the way to Scandinavia.
They got them here in Boulder.
Yeah, right. Yeah, not to mention eventually going across the oceans. Okay. But of course, you know, the fun thing about that list that really strikes you is, wait a minute, India's not in the list.
True.
Okay. Yeah, and of course we'll get to that here shortly. You know, it peters away in its source land, you know, and takes hold elsewhere. And of course we've got Sri Lanka, and Myanmar and Thailand, you know, now instead of Burma and Siam, but. But still, you know, it goes all over the place. And then that final statement, and generally speaking, I mean, you know it's going to have issues, but generally speaking, it was a religion vastly superior to those which it supplanted or upstepped. Because often, you know, it's going into a place that is just way down in the mire of very primitive, superstitious thinking. You know, where you're, you know, every shadow's a boogeyman sort of, you know, environment. Yeah, so anything, is an improvement practically in some of these locations. And this was a distinct improvement, as they pointed out. Okay, what else do they give us here?
The spread of Buddhism from its homeland in India to all of Asia is one of the thrilling stories of the spiritual devotion and missionary persistence of sincere religionists. The teachers of Gautama's gospel not only brave the perils of the overland caravan routes, but face the dangers of the China seas as they pursued their mission over the Asiatic continent, bringing to all peoples the message of their faith. But this Buddhism was no longer the simple doctrine of Gautama. It was the miraculized gospel which made him a god. And the farther Buddhism spread from its highland home in India, the more unlike the teachings of Gautama it became, and the more like the religions it supplanted it grew to be.
Okay, so just like the Melchizedek missionaries, you obviously have this diffusion, you know, and submergence phenomenon that, you know, that happens as it spreads out. You know, and you're, no matter how much he sets it up in contrast, you're going to get miracles, stuff, you know, trickling back in. All that natural stuff will, of course, trickle back in. But, right, just like with the Melchizedek missionaries, the spread of Buddhism from its homeland in India to all of Asia is one of the thrilling stories of the spiritual devotion and missionary persistence of sincere religionists, right? Notice how similar the statements are to what they said about the Melchizedek missionaries. So, I mean, in that sense, too, you can see why it said it was more representative of the Melchizedek truths than any other religious system to be found throughout Eastern Asia. Just the very fact that it spread, and you have to talk about it, it's like, wait a minute, are they talking about the Melchizedek missionaries, or are they talking about the Buddhist missionaries? Right? It's so similar. What happened? Let's see here. Anything else? Like we pointed out a while ago, you know, it didn't take long, and you know, he wasn't just this very insightful, inspiring guy from India. You know, he was a god. Not unlike Thor, right? See, so that's why I said, you know, when it finally gets to Scandinavia, it's like, well, do I want, you know, this northern hero that we believe is a god, or this southern hero that they believe is a god, right? You know, it's a straightforward trade-off to believe in Thor, to believe in Buddha.
Yep. Do you think a Buddha ever became as much of a god as Jesus did become?
Well, I mean, see, the difference obviously is, at best, he's a lowercase g god here, as you see, because this is a bottom-up notion, right? I mean, Jesus isn't just some guy that Christians believe is God, lowercase g, in a bottom-up exaltation, right? That's literal, personalized deity that came down and incarnated. You know, and remember that concept the fact of Jesus didn't start. Remember, you had that getting seeded with the fact that Melchizedek was incarnated. Remember, they were kind of spreading that, right? That got into the water from the Melchizedek missionaries, and then booster shot with the Christian missionaries. And a lot of other peoples really thought, oh, you know, I really like that top-down notion. Let's work the Buddha thing more into a top-down mode, where we think of him in some transcendent fact that comes down and is incarnated too. So, you know, Buddhism evolves into that mode, see, playing off of Christianity and the Melchizedek seeding. Right, but the literalness of a creator son, that's capital G God, that's literally personalized capital D deity, you know, a pre-existent spirit being, if you will, celestial being, through very inscrutable physics, you know, is incarnated into a mortal for a time.
Yep. So, and the way Buddhism keeps that in place is that they say that there's a succession of Buddhas that should be...
Yeah, we're going to read that in a little bit. See, it's coming up. Yeah, we're going to talk about literally what I was just saying. Yeah, it's coming up.
Only in Latin alphabet
you
have uppercase and lowercase.
Yeah.
Other languages.
Yes, right. And, you know, and of course, even in some Latinized languages, German, all the nouns are uppercase, right? Right. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why, you know, you can't properly translate this book, you know, and a lot of languages, because there's a, you know, capital S supremacy and lowercase s supremacy are very distinctly different facts, right? You know, and you can't blur them together. And if you don't separate those, you're introducing error into your thinking, right? So, you know, it's inescapable that any translation will become more erroneous if, you know, for nothing, for simple issues like that. Anyway, back to this. Okay, so, it does get spread, and it's certainly a positive thing, but it does have this, suffers from the same issue of starting to, you know, as it rolls out to far and wide, it accumulates like a snowball, all the stuff it's rolling through, right? You know, And it becomes more and more difficult when you see the snowball, you know, in China, say, after it's rolled all the way from India, right, to see the India Gautama center of it, right? You've got all of this accumulation is what you see first, right? And so you think Buddhism is that and not the truth at the core. Right? You think of it in terms of all that, you know, that evolutionary accumulation that it's rolled through. Okay, let's keep going.
Buddhism, later on, was much affected by Taoism in China, Shinto in Japan, and Christianity in Tibet. After 1,000 years in India, Buddhism simply withered and expired. It became Brahmanized and later abjectly surrendered to Islam. While throughout much of the rest of the Orient, it degenerated into a ritual which Gautama Siddhartha would never have recognized.
And of course, we've already spoken to that. I mean, they tell you point blank. The descriptor for how distorted it became is a grotesque perversion of what Gautama initiated. Right? I mean, it, you know, what it rolls through is unfortunate. Right? Now, you know, notice I already alluded to that. You know, it became Brahmanized. Okay? In India, that pre-existent, very abstract, diffused Brahma concept just completely washed it out so it could easily just disappear under the definitiveness of Islam. And then as they point out, you know, heads to China and Japan, see, in both cases, right, it's going to pick up some scheme of the way, right? Taoism, right? There's way, and Shinto, the to part is way, right? Those Easterners like that way thing, right? That conception. And so Buddhism is going to become wayized, right? It, you know, the theology of Buddhism as it goes to the East is going to be rationalized more in that sense of a certain way, a certain path, right? A certain road, a certain vehicle, right? Whatever way you interpret that. Yeah.
Even today in China, which is secular, it's not, this isn't a religious idea, but they have one belt, one road.
Yeah.
Which kind of implies a way to go.
Right. Right, the Great Road, to be precise, right? You know, right, as we're about to read. One belt, one road. I mean, that concept, like we talked about before when we were talking about in China, right, that Tao concept, no matter how much things changed and whatnot, that was, you know, really captured everyone's imagination in a foundational way. They always are going back to that and building a scheme on that basic notion.
And also, there is a big difference between the Mahayana.
Yeah, we're getting there. That's coming up. Yeah, not yet. You're jumping ahead. We're going to read that next. All right. Okay, so let's see. Anything else there? Just the fact that they threw in after 1,000 years. Okay, you know, so, you know, they're rolling forward. And you know, one of the things to it eventually we'll get to, we won't get to it tonight, but, you know, the time scale for things to change under natural evolutionary process is pretty long in Buddhism, right? You know, 1,000 years is just a kind of a beginning, right, of anything changing. So it's... And some parts of it, like he was just pointing out, we're going to read here in a second, don't want to change at all. All right. So what about these two different modes that develop, as he was just hinting at?
In the South, the fundamentalist stereotype of the teachings of Siddhartha persisted in Ceylon, Burma, and the Indochina Peninsula. This is the Hinayana division of Buddhism, which clings to the early or asocial doctrine.
All right, so Hinayana, You know, the yana part there again. Okay, that's that way thing that we were saying is going to come into play here. Well, yeah, the next paragraph will explain it all in more detail. But notice the thing they want to just tell you up front is in this little tiny paragraph. No matter what it's called, and how that contrasts with the other one. There's a mode that's fundamentalist. In other words, it looks to the past. Right? You know, you have whether or not you are thinking in a preserve mode. That's a fundamentalist mode, right? So you're looking to the past. Whether you think in just a straightforward observe mode, where you might say you're orthodox, right? Just what's straight in front of you. You know, or do you think in a future-oriented way of conserve? Remember, preserve, past, observe, present, conserve, future. Right? And there's such a tendency for that existential thought in a religionist, to point to the past. If for nothing else, think about it. It's like if you really don't have much of a future time orientation, and you're really only the two options you think of is the present or the past. Might not the past be a little bit more compelling, because you have this kind of eternity notion, this kind of forever going on and on forever sort of a notion. And the present doesn't really give you that very easily. You have to be more abstract to get it out of the present, but the past is just like it just goes back there forever, right? See, so it can easily kind of satisfy you in a very simple way to have having eternity in it, because it just goes back forever, right? And remember how with evolutionary religion, the farther back something is, the more sacred it is, in the natural human way of thinking about things. The old stuff is always more powerful, right? The old magic is always more powerful than the new magic. Right? If for nothing else, it gets closer to eternity the farther back it goes. See, like I was just saying. So,
what is the asocial?
I'm getting that. Asocial? Yeah, I'm getting that here. Just one second. Right. So that fundamentalist one, it's going to try to preserve the original sort of moray structure. And what was that? It was monastic. Right? You don't have any sort of social ministry mentality to you, right? You go off by yourself, mono, right? You go off alone, monastically, right? And seek for nirvana, within yourself. Maybe you shun the social stuff just because it's distracting. It requires all your attention to, right, isolate yourself and not get caught up in the affairs of the world to try to find this enlightened state. Right, so that's the Hinayana. That's just that original. It's not anti-social. It's not for or against social. It's apart from social. It's just yourself. It's asocial. It's not social. It's monastic. So that's that kind of, and they see themselves as purist. Right? Now the others are corrupting the pure faith by bringing in evolutionary additions and stuff. We're holding on to the pure original, right? They're like the master's parable about, I buried what the talents you gave me, master. Here it is exactly as you gave it to me when you left. They want to be those ones, and when the master returns, they can say, here it is exactly the way you left it, right? So that's the fundamentalist mode. Okay, what about the non-fundamentalists?
But even before the collapse in India, the Chinese and North Indian groups of Gautama's followers had begun the development of the Mahayana teaching of the, quote, great road to salvation in contrast with the purists of the South who held to the Hinayana or lesser road. And these Mahayanaists cast loose from the social limitations inherent in the Buddhist doctrine. And ever since has this northern division of Buddhism continued to evolve in China and Japan.
All right. So there you have the two roads. Right? Is it the lesser road, Hinayana, or is it the greater road, Mahayana? And as I was saying, whether or not you say road or way or vehicle or whatever, right? I mean, it's just plays upon that original way sense of Shinto or Taoism, right? That path concept. Very, very compelling to rationalize everything in predicated on a path concept.
What did they do in contrast to being monastic?
Okay, and what did they do in contrast is they're just pointing out they're going to do many different things. The whole point is they're not going to be merely that. They're going to launch forward, and it's going to begin to split into all sorts of different flavors, some of them a little bit progressive, some of them very progressive. By the time we get to the end of this paper, which we won't tonight, they'll show us just how far along that greater road some of those people went. Right? Like I was saying, I mean, the so-called greater road is going to progress because they're not going to be so fixated on the past. Right? Maybe some of them are kind of just going along with the present, kind of just drafting off of the greater, social, moray system or whatever. But there's others that are going to start to look more individually forward, and they're going to begin to progress, and it's going to be situationally dependent, how they progress, how much they progress. I mean, there's going to be many different flavors of a greater road. We can play with the way analogy. Each of us has an absolutely unique way that we eventually have to strike step with. Our personality is absolutely unique. Each of us will purpose things in our unique way, right? It's a very useful word, see, trying to understand, what's going on. You can quickly see why the Easterners, delighted in it and still do. There's a lot of truth that you can express in that way. Pardon the pun. But obviously when you go on a more transcendent, a greater way, right, it's bound to get more and more personal, and hence more and more diverse.
I just can't imagine, what is it like churches? They get together in the town square.
Well, I'll leave it to exercise you if you don't know any Buddhists, to do a little research and see all the different ways, again, pardon the pun, that they definitely, will think more in those, have some more of an outward oriented material idealism mode. They'll have some sort of a social ministry concept, trying to help people with their suffering, whatever it might be, something that isn't just about you, and your inner journey to enlightenment, and you could care less if there's another person on the planet.
Right? It's funny, I don't know.
Yeah, well, we're about to read, and then there's Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, we haven't gotten to that yet. That's another story altogether in many ways. Did we get everything there? I think we did, didn't we? Let's keep going.
Buddhism is a living, growing religion today because it succeeds in conserving many of the highest moral values of its adherents. It promotes calmness and self-control, augments serenity and happiness, and does much to prevent sorrow and mourning. Those who believe this philosophy live better lives than many who do not.
So the final thing they want to say, see, is again reminding you to see how useful this is in many ways in an evolutionary context. Okay? But just, you know, look at the way they're saying that. Despite the positive elements of what they're saying there, you can see at least between the lines that this is not going to, you know, you can't play this game forever. Right? It's going to start to be burning fumes, right? You're going to run out of gas with how far this is going to take anyone.
But it says living, growing. Like, that's pretty
powerful. Right, yeah. And maybe that's for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, you know, it's fine. Okay, but not millions and millions and millions of years. All right, at some point, right, there's going to need to be, if nothing else, a personal God concept, or it's not going to go very far, right?
Oops, I forgot about that.
Obviously, you know, see, you know, the downside of not being asocial, right, there's an obvious upside to not being asocial, but there's a downside. You start to focus so much on the external world that you lose sight of the inner life, right? You get so worried about, you know, this person has this disease, and this person, you know, just, you know, their home just burned down, and, you know, and this person is sleeping on the street. And I mean, you get so focused on material external affairs, right, that you begin to lose the predicate for an enlightened relationship to the external world. You lose that inner light, that inner life. If you get too focused on it, you need a balance, right? Your life is supposed to be the super additive consequence of a relationship between a genuine, enduring inner life and an active, living outer life. Not one or the other. Okay, but like I said, it promotes calmness, right, and self-control, augments serenity and happiness. Right, even happiness, right? You know, and you know, they don't mean tail wagging, you know, they mean real happiness, right? Transcendent of joy. Right, Buddhists, you know, discover that unnatural mode of responding positively to a negative stimulus, right? That you know, is imposed upon them, right? That can lead to happiness, genuine happiness, not just mere joy. Right, so it's got its positives, right? But it's humanism, right? Right. When all is said and done, I mean, it's only super consciously a religion, right? It's not consciously a religion because there's no God.
But right? Could that change, like John was saying?
Yes, yeah.
If it doesn't have the personal God, it would really be something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, remember, that's the final section in this paper where they talk about that. All right, we'll get to that next week. Okay.
Maybe.
We'll get to that next week. Okay. So what about, right, you know, this little side note, okay, before they continue on with the story, we got to have a little side note. What about in Tibet? Right, because remember they said, you know, in that list, you know, Tibet, Kashmir, Ceylon, et cetera, right? What happened when it went north into that, you know, vast sea of Tibet? What did you get?
Section 10, Religion in Tibet. In Tibet may be found the strangest association of the Melchizedek teachings combined with Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, and Christianity. When the Buddhist missionaries entered Tibet, they encountered a state of primitive savagery very similar to that which the early Christian missionaries found among the northern tribes of Europe.
Okay, so that's an interesting little element. So anything is going to be a booster shot, kind of what they're saying, because it's primitive savagery that they're stepping into. And he goes like, why do they mention the parallel to Christian missionaries, you know, going into Northern Europe? You know, like I was talking about Thor a while back. What happens when you have a Sangic people that get a little bit more definitive Andite juicing, right? You can find blue-eyed people from way back in Tibet, right? We talked way back about the Andites moving, you know, eastward. And so you have a similar situation. You have some very animated people that really need the prince and his staff, you know, and Adam and Eve and whatnot to help them have a better structure to be animated within. But we don't have that. And so you can get a people that can be kind of aggressively savage, okay, because of that little bit of biologic juicing. They're hinting between the lines at the parallel there. And just to remind you, you know, when you think of ultimate passiveness, you know, these days, you know, many of you will think of the Dalai Lama, the great ocean of, you know, the great Pacific, literally ocean, right? the Dalai Lama. But that's not the genetic roots. Okay. Very aggressive, primitive, savage place to begin with. Okay. Now one of the biggest mouthful paragraphs in the whole book. Okay.
These simple-minded Tibetans would not wholly give up their ancient magic and charms. Examination of the religious ceremonials of present-day Tibetan rituals reveals an overgrown brotherhood of priests with shaven heads who practice an elaborate ritual embracing bells, chants, incense. Excuse me.
Definitely not incense. Incense.
Incense, processionals, rosaries, images, charms, pictures, holy water, gorgeous vestments, and elaborate choirs. They have rigid dogmas and crystallized creeds, mystic rites and special fasts. Their hierarchy embraces monks, nuns, abbots, and the Grand Lama. They pray to angels, saints, a holy mother, and the gods. They practice confessions and believe in purgatory. Their monasteries are extensive and their cathedrals magnificent. They keep up an endless repetition of sacred rituals and believe that such ceremonials bestow salvation. Prayers are fastened to a wheel, and with its turning, they believe the petitions become efficacious. Among no other people of modern times can be found the observance of so much from so many religions. And it is inevitable that such a cumulative liturgy would become inordinately cumbersome and intolerably burdensome.
Yeah, like I said, what a litany.
Sort of like what they were describing.
Yes, yes. What?
Did we know a lot about Tibet before the Ranch book was presented?
Yeah, of course. Right, I mean, you know, what are they doing here? They're taking what you know about Tibet putting it all together in nice, pithy fashion so hopefully it will become clear to you what you've got. And if it wasn't clear, you know, they say it at the end, right? Inordinately cumbersome and intolerably burdensome, right? Remember when we went through evolutionary religion, we saw that no matter what concept humans came up with, the constant was as time went by, it got more and more complicated. Wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels, you know, as time goes on. That's our natural process. Right, the poster children for this, right, as they're saying, are the Tibetan Buddhists. Right? Those that have taken this to the greatest extremes, not only taking one particular line into infinite complexity, but accumulating everyone's lines together into a giant, rationalized, heterogeneous mass of complexity. It is, just like I said, it's the poster child for this phenomenon. And, if nothing else, when you're, beset with all of this ritual, it's not surprising that you would conclude that the point of this ritual is to eventually be saved from it. You notice that, right? Their concept of, that they believe that such ceremonials bestow salvation. And think about how closed loop that is. Yeah, salvation from what? From the very burdensome mass that they've beset themselves with. I mean, if there was anyone on the planet that Jesus was thinking of when he said, "You shall know the truth and the truth will set you free," he was thinking of them. If only they could just know the simple truth and be set free from all this elaborate folderol that we dream up that is utterly devoid of anything. Right? And if you think I'm being too extreme, before we comment anymore, read the final little paragraph.
"The Tibetans have something of all the leading world religions except the simple teachings of the Jesusonian gospel: sonship with God, brotherhood with man, and ever-ascending citizenship in the eternal universe."
Right. They have something of all the leading world religions except something actually relevant. Right. There's another way of finishing that sentence.
Kind of the dumpster.
They have everything that is of no consequence. Right. Right. Including, I told you we'd come back around to, spirit is breath, right? And like we talked about way back, and hence it's going to be tied to wind, right? How do you make a prayer spiritual and hence effective? You put it on the wheel and you make artificial wind by, instead of making the wind go by the prayer, right? You make the prayer go by the air, right? It's, an artificial wind, so it's caught up in the spirit, and it's effective.
Perfect.
And then I'll get to you.
And in the Western world, are we that far advanced? No.
No.
We all revere the Dalai Lama.
Of course. And
he's always laughing, though.
But of course, see, one of the reasons why we revere the Dalai Lama, and he's become such a rock star, is what they were talking about before, right? That it promotes calmness and self-control, augments serenity and happiness. Okay, you can't help but notice, despite all of the folderol, that at least he's not running around with his hair on fire all the time, like you are. It's like, well, that's kind of cool. To see the positive in it all, unlike with Jesus, most people don't consider him beside himself, right? When he acts unnaturally like that, when he responds positively to a negative stimulus, he's got something, but step back, okay? Where does it really all go? I mean, fortunately, we don't have to worry about whether or not he gets somewhere by himself. We all get to where we need to go by grace now, right? So all of our notions are irrelevant. The question of the fifth epical revelation is, okay, not pointing out how you should delight in the grace that you're given and rest on that, on the laurels of that, but it's like, how about taking delight in cultivating? What can you do beyond grace? Why Why are you given that initial gift of grace? What's the point of it? Is it an end in itself? Or is it a beginning? Right? Is it a beginning of divine potential? Or is it an ending of divine actuality? Well, that's not going to go well. If I run with that one, I'm going to think I'm innately divine, and now I've joined the Lucifer Rebellion. Okay? Yeah, just 1 second, Jean. She had a question here first.
So I was just kind of sitting with the Jesusonian gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly is the Jesusonian gospel?
Well, they gave it to you right there.
Because the whole paragraph, we're kind of going with hearing that the hierarchy embraces monks and nuns and abbots and grandmama and holy mother.
Right, right. Right. It's not it's obviously not the Christian gospel. Right, or the Christian mores system or institution. Right, I mean, they use that term Jesusonian to point to not the religion about Jesus, Christianity, but the religion of Jesus. Jesusonian refers to the religion of Jesus, the simple, like they're saying, straightforward religious frame that Jesus was encouraging you to adopt, right?
Is it meaning Jesus in a chapel? Are we talking about Jesus?
No, it has nothing to do with any institutions. It has to do just with you. I see there's a truth to the monastic sort of a thing of those Hinayana Buddhists, right? Religion is not an outer life thing. It has nothing to do with cathedrals or incense or organs or singing or anything, rituals of any sort. Real religion is a purely inner life fact. It's nothing whatever to do with the outer life, right? In the inner life, you recognize the fact of the fatherhood of God, and you recognize the truth of your relationship as a child to that father, your sonship with God. Obviously not using father and son in anthropomorphic ways here. Right, like we're ignoring daughters and brothers and mothers or something. No, right? We're using it. You have that initiator God, God the Father. Right, recognizing the fact of Him as a transcendent initiator, and that He's initiated you, and hence you're like Him. You're father like. You're a son. Right, whether or not you're a human male or female is irrelevant. Right? But that is the good news. There's a real existential initiator, and He really has given you a gift of divine initiation, a personality, an infinite potential that He's given to you. Take a hold of it. Recognize that you're a child of that real God, right? And then, as they say there, see, besides that sonship with God, you know, that immediately implies, oh, well, that's not just me. That's also you and you and you and you and you, right? Oh. So, okay, you too. Right, so,
if you have to go.
So even though it's not the case materially, in a born-again sense, in a spiritually, right, we're brothers and sisters. Right, and then you also recognize. Well, wait a minute. If the Father has reached down and initiated me, I'll bet you the first thing that's kind of built into me is I return to that source point and say thank you before I get on with the rest of my life. Yeah, the initial thing is I have an ascending citizenship, right, in the eternal universe. Right? So all of that inner recognition, all of which has nothing to do with dogmas, teachings of priests or whatever, right? It by grace, you're given the ability to recognize those facts. Fact, the fatherhood of God, right? And the logical truth of the brotherhood of man. And And then all of the consequences that go with that, like an ascending universe career, that just dawns in your mind by grace in an inner life. And that's all Jesus was here to do, was say, go to your inner life. It's like, well, where is it, Jesus? Well, it was put there when you were roughly age 6. You need to not literally go back to being a childish 6-year-old, but you need to go back in truth. You need to go back and enter that kingdom within that was put there as a child. Go there as that humble, innocent child. Find that cosmic foundation that you were given by grace. And start anew with that predicate. Be born again. Have a spiritual predicate. That's the Jesusonian gospel, the Jesusonian good news, the religion of Jesus good news.
Can we say religion of Jesus is the teachings of Jesus?
No, versus, it's not.
Religion about Jesus would be the station.
See, that's the thing. The religion of Jesus is not to be found in part 4 of this book, in the life and teachings of Jesus. That's not the religion of Jesus. Right? And they tell you that in part 4. Part 4 is the life and teachings of Jesus, and in talking about the life and teachings of Jesus, they talk about the religion of Jesus. What is it fundamentally? What's the name of the last paper in the book? The faith of Jesus. The faith of Jesus, right? The inner life nucleus of reality, that faith nucleus, right? The religion of Jesus is the faith of Jesus foundationally. And each of us is encouraged to have that exact same faith. It's like, well, Jesus was a creator. No. Not Michael. Jesus, the man, the first section of the last paper, Jesus the man, not Michael the God, that's of no use to you. Jesus the man, right? And his human, mortal, based faith. Take a hold, be born again. Take a hold of that genuine spirit nucleus within you. Predicate your life on that. That's the religion of Jesus. Religion is personal spiritual experience. Okay? So it's personal. That means it can only happen in the upper domain, in the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. It's not something that happens in the lower domain where you have feelings, and that lower domain that relates to the external world has nothing to do with that. It's personal, so it's in the upper domain, above feelings, and that upper domain is what engages spirit above, right? Personal, spiritual, right? It's so the mind that is that is predicated on spiritual influence, spirit substance influence on mind, right? The interplay between the two, experience, personal, spiritual experience. That's the definition of religion, right? And finally, you can think about the word religion literally, which no one ever does. I mean, religion starts with an R-E prefix. Back. What is the back referring to? Back to what? Back to the future, right? Back to the past. Man, we're just reading about fundamentalists. Is that what R-E means? We should look back to the past? That's why the R-E is in religion? No. Right? Religion, what's the root part? Bind. It's talking about being bound back. Bound back to what? Bound back to eternity. Right? Religion is the part of you that's bound back to eternity through spirit. Not the part of you that's bound to matter and time. Right? Which is what we, the conscious stuff that all religionists talk about is not really religion. It's alligion. It's bound to stuff, bound to temporal material affairs. It's not about being bound back through spirit to eternity, genuine religion, right? So again, genuine religion has nothing to do with the external world, the outer life. That's religion, right? That's religion in name only. Right? Literally, it's religion. But that doesn't mean just because you're bound back to eternity, you're not only that. Jesus doesn't say, seek only, you Hinayanists. No, don't seek only, seek first. Right? Find that first, really find that first, and now go down and out to the external world, minister to your fellow children of God based upon that recognition within you, that religious, genuine religious consciousness, right, that you're bound back to eternity. Right? And even if all earthly things crash, no real harm can befall you because your feet are not in time anymore. So it doesn't matter how chaotic time gets. You're not standing on it anymore. It can totally blow up. It's of no consequence. You're standing on eternity. It stands unmoved. Eternity could care less about time.
The religion of the Spirit of God that dwells in the mind of man.
Right, right. Like I said, you know, way back at the beginning, to recognize that eternity has no relationship to time. Okay? It's not just a lot of time or something, or a fancy way to think about time. And once you get eternity literally bound away from time, then you go, oh my goodness. And yet I know that there's an interplay between time and eternity. Ooh, there's mystery. Matter of fact, there's the mystery of mysteries. How does eternity have any interplay with time? How can the personality, which is from eternity, have any identification with me in time? How can the thought adjuster, which is of eternity, have any residence within my mind in time? All of these connections between eternity and time are the mystery of mysteries. Right?
So how can you say there's no relation if there's these connections?
Right. See, there's...
It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Up, you know, see, immediately, rationally, there's no connection. And yet, you know, experientially can prove there is. It's like, I know there is. I know I'm not standing on time right now. I'm standing on eternity. It's self-evident. Time is jiggling all over the place, and I'm not moving, so I'm not standing on it. What am I standing on? Okay, you know, it's like, So somehow, there's something that shouldn't have any relationship does. It's like, okay, well, it's impossible for it to relate front door to front door. Oh, what does the fifth ethical revelation says? You've got to stop thinking so linearly, right? Use an ellipse. And your pre-existent linear thinking is just the long side of the ellipse. And you're thinking that the only way to go from point A to point B is along that apparent line, that long side of the ellipse. But there's another way. You can't get to eternity to time front door to front door along the line, but you can get from eternity to time by going the other way around the ellipse. You can get to it through the back door.
So it means it does have a relationship
with
time.
It just not one that you can, right, not one that you can understand analytically, which is looking through the front door, right? But you know it exists, right? And so you need some way to visualize that. That's why the revelers should say, think ellipse. Ellipse is a great analogy for you to think about this. And you can understand the front door thing because, you know, don't think circle because then there's no kind of quasi-line. Think ellipse. So there's a quasi-line that you've been thinking you were stuck in. No, step back. It's actually that apparent line is just the long side of a big ellipse.
Okay. You came up with back door, right?
Yeah. Right? Well, they talk about backing into truth and some things like that. Some, you know. That's, you know, it's just, you know, you're a very linear being, you know, consciously. So you're facing, you know, out the front door along the line, see. But you got to recognize, I can go back. See, I can go through the back door. I can be bound back to eternity. Instead of trying to bind myself to something in time and matter through the front door, let me bind myself back to eternity through the back door. That's why the R-E prefix is in religion, because you got to go through the back door.
You've talked about facets of deity with this back door thing. I wish I could remember how that goes.
Hey, I mean, just think about how we've got this word religion and no one knows why. No one knows what the word means. Everyone uses it. It's like, but no one can explain it. I just did. How did I do it? Because I'm the enlightened one? No, it's because I have the fifth epical revelation. And it says, do you ever think about it like this? You go, oh, for Pete's sake. Of course, that's what it means. All they have to do is just give you a little hint, and then it's obvious. That's why we call it religion.
So bound there. It's unity, oneness, and rebound means return to
oneness. We talked about that. See, I mean, occasionally religionists have tried to figure out, why do we like these R-E words like religion and redemption and et cetera? Why do we have all these R-E? You know, and the only way they've never been able to think about it is temporally, that you've got some notion where you need to imagine that you can turn time back and, you know, and redeem yourself and be as if it was in the past before you messed it all up. Right, they think that the R-E's and all their favorite words are back in time. It's like, no, it doesn't have anything to do with back in time. You're thinking temporally. No, it has nothing to do with time at all. It's being bound back to eternity. That's what the R-E prefix is about.
There's no salvation to be found in the reconnecting of time.
Yeah, right.
That's the dead joining the dead.
Right.
So back means we have already been.
No, it has nothing to do with time.
No, we have already been in eternity. So we're going
no, back. No, no, so no, we haven't. See, that's, you know,
so you're not returning.
You've,
it's a new thing, so.
You've been given a future from a time viewpoint, a future relationship with eternity, right? You aren't trying to go back to a past relationship with eternity, right? It's, see, I mean, you don't want to think about eternity temporally, right? It's more like a place, right? Than it is some point in time or something, or some, you know, notion about time, right? You're in time and you go out of time into eternity, this other place, and then you can come back out into time. Eternity, think of it as parallel to time. Okay. Yeah, you can extend time to being an infinite line. Think of a parallel infinite line that you call eternity. Think about going back and forth between the two rails of the railroad track. Right? Think of it parallel. Okay, you got some? Nope? Okay.
Well, absent-enters are kind of eternity.
Well, no, that's transcended time. That's another story. Yeah. So you can take the next step and think about something in between time and eternity, you know, something that you call transcendent time.
Well, the basic thing to me that the Ranch book really teaches, it's pretty easy to get a hold of, is this real concept of the Spirit of God living within you, which is really your, you know, eventually you and the Spirit become one. And what does that mean? You know, from my point of view, I'd much rather become one with the Spirit than have the Spirit become one with me, only because... The Spirit's, in my opinion anyway,
it's appropriate.
A whole lot more about what's right for me than I do. So if I listen to the Spirit and God, and that whole concept to me, that God actually has given a part, which a lot of Christians have a hard time with, because, you know, being actually having a part of God within you, to me is like the whole thing, what he's talking about here is the whole real thing of what real religion really is just to be able to then. And when you sort of get little inklings, because it doesn't happen overnight, you're grown in the Spirit, then, and you can start to see that when you start realizing and talking and thinking in spiritual ways, how that touches and can reach the Spirit inside other people. And when you're really talking to the Spirit inside other people, you know, you may not see the reaction right away and the... You know, on the outer world side, mm-hmm. but something does happen inside with people because they do have a part of God within them and a spirit of truth, etc. And it really works.
I mean, it takes a while, you know, to be able to realize how to do that, but there's the recognition of the, as you say, the spirit of the spirit substance is tricky. I mean, it's like you pick it up here a little bit here.
But the key is, you know, even, you don't have, like you're just saying, you don't have to see anything. Just start to, you know, engage someone knowing, despite all appearances of the contrary, knowing that the Spirit of God lives within them. Treat them, you know, knowing that fact. Treat them appropriately. You know, your worst enemy, the most vile person you can think of, has the Spirit of God living in them. Okay? God loves them absolutely. And Jesus gave us a new commandment. To love your enemies and to love them in the same way he loved others, to love them with fatherly love, right? The only way that you can begin to get from brotherly love to fatherly love is to stop thinking about loving your friends and start thinking about loving your enemies. As long as you're thinking about loving your friends, you're really going to be stuck in brotherly love. Well, you know, it's what gets you to fatherly love.
If you have kids and stuff like that, you get an understanding of the difference of...
But still, that's kin likeness. That's kindness, right? That's brotherly love, even though you call it even though it's father child.
But you're
correct that there's, if you can start to think about how not only do you have the immediacy of blood kinship, so you have brotherly love with your family, but you are a parent, and as you start to think. You know, about that more vertical relationship to your child, that gives you a hint at how to start moving towards fatherly love, where your child just did something that you told them absolutely not to do. Okay, do you respond in kind, or do you respond transcendently?
Give them a whooping, right?
Right. Do you respond to them with brotherly love, right, or with fatherly love, right? See, it gives you a potential to start to look at it transcendently.
And fatherly love does have discipline.
But like I said, if you want to really take it all the way to what Jesus was talking about when he said, I want you to love people like I love, right? That it's when he said, love your enemies. That's what brings it home, right? You know, and then take it the other thing he said, right? Take that person that you despise the most. You don't have to literally do it, but conceptually begin to think about it. Take that person in the world you despise the most, and to supremely express your love for that person, what did Jesus say? You have to be willing to die for them. Right? Imagine your worst enemy, the person you think is the most despicable thing that should be removed from the earth. Are you willing to die for them? Well, you haven't gotten to the heights of fatherly love yet then. So you got work to do. Right? You're not required to get there. That's, you know, what you have your eyes set on, going to those extremes. Jesus was willing to die for those that were screaming, crucify him.
Of millions of inhabited worlds,
okay.
Evolving souls who are about to give up the fight, have taken one more look at Jesus on the cross, you know, giving his life for, as you say, just a second ago, for his enemies. And forged on ahead. I mean, it's an amazing thing when you think about it.
Fatherly love is not relative. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything that they've done or even are. You love them for their infinite potential that is not yet. Right? It's a totally different love. Right? Brotherly love is stuck with actuality. Fatherly love sets aside actuality. And engages the reality of potentiality and loves its infinite divinity.
So I was thinking, I think sometimes you use Hitler as an example. So what I was going to say is Hitler could, by contrast, completely flip.
You don't have to pick a particular boogeyman like Hitler or something, but
or
just anyone, you know. Pick the person that you were screaming purple-faced at yesterday. You know, start with that one instead of the abstraction of Hitler, you know, or Judas or something. All right? I mean, pick something more, you know, more tangible.
But what I meant is that whoever that might be mm-hmm. might see they might see themselves for what they are, and that potential completely flip themselves because they can see that contrast of what they were and what.
And again, if you want to, go to someone like Hitler. I mean, Hitler loved, God loved Hitler absolutely the same as he loves you. He can't know the difference, and so he doesn't love any difference, right? He has no relationship to the difference, right? In potential, they're equal, right? He loves you. He doesn't love you relatively. He loves you absolutely.
But I'm talking about not the father, but Hitler himself seeing his own contrast.
If you want to just go to Hitler, it's like, people like to make him the infinite boogeyman, what does iniquity look like? Well, it must look like Hitler. It's like, iniquity is a lot greater than, outer life doings of someone like Hitler, And if nothing else, maybe he really loved Eva Braun. So was he iniquitous? No. Okay,
even Lucifer said, I can't judge you because I'm your...
Right, until Lucifer is literally iniquitous, right, and literally depersonalizes, God loves him absolutely the same as you. Until the day he chooses to depersonalize that final choice, that final step to iniquity, nothing changes with the Universal Father. He can blow up the entire local system with a rebellion. God's love doesn't change one iota. Everyone's temporal relationships, Michael's relationship has issues and stuff. Even though, despite what you were just saying, it still has issues. Michael interns him, eventually, and this, right. Things change with the beings in time, but with the Universal Father, absolutely nothing has changed. Nothing has changed one iota. Because he doesn't love you relative to whether or not you've started a rebellion or not. He loves you absolutely.
And love is an interesting term.
Right, we could go off on that tangent too. Yeah. I don't know, at this point, maybe we shouldn't even start the next section. I wasn't going to get through it. I was hoping to get a couple paragraphs in, but I guess it's impossible. So let's just answer some more questions.
Back to the word religion. Mm-hmm. As to word religion, Mr. John said, recognition, to recognize, to know again, for example, or realization, or realignment, to align again, or return, to turn back again.
Some of the rewords do mean back in time.
So if we follow this, then legion would mean to bind or to join. So religion would be to join again or to return into that state of unity or joining. So is it was or am I
See the reason. So the reason that sometimes the re prefix means again, is because you interpret the back to be back in time.
Back into time.
But you don't have to.
There's a notion that I had already been there.
I agree. Redo. Okay.
Yeah.
There's one where you did it. You're going to do it again. Okay, I'm not saying that re always means what I'm talking about, but in the word religion, what it really means is being bound back to eternity and not to think of it temporally, to think of it spiritually, like Jesus said, right? God is your spiritual father, so you need to find him through spirit. You can't find him through matter and through temporal doings. You got to find him through spirit back in eternity, okay? And re-recognition is another word like that, where you can have a scholar talk about what they think maybe the construct recognition means, to think about again, say, okay. But he hasn't yet recognized what recognition really is. That's something you only discover through that's a philosophic thing that you discover through this philosophic text. Recognition is a very important word to finally understand its objective meaning. You know, and to discover that RE prefix is most objectively understood, again, is being a bound back. Now, in that case, it's not, don't think all the way back to eternity, but being bound back to the cosmos, the temporal whole. Now, you know, you have, you know, see, it's one thing to deduce something through a thought process. It's another thing to just, without any deductive reasoning, to just say, you know, it's just self-evident that such and such is the case. It's like, well, how do you know? Well, I just recognize that. Well, what do you mean, recognize it? It's like, well, you know, I can look at it down in time and try to rationalize it, or I can step back up into the context of the whole, into the context of the cosmos, and think about it anew. I can think about it in the big picture, and when I think about it in the big picture, it's just self-evident, because of the wholeness of the system, that it has to be this way. The objective recognition of the three cosmic intuitions is what they try to teach us in the fifth ethical revelation, at the beginning, right? That you, by grace, are given this ability to recognize, to recognize. And that's something different than your subjective sense, what you could call sensation recognition, where I look over here and I go, and I say to myself, what's that thing? Okay, so I go back to my memory.
Remember.
You know, I go back to my memory and I think about it again, predicated on my memory, and go, oh yeah, I remember, that's a cup. There's a sensation recognition, see, where you're using the word recognition as a kind of going back in time, if you will, or back to your memories. But there's another way that the revelators use the word recognition that's not that subjective way. It has nothing to do with memory, right? When I say something is self-evident, I don't mean I'm going back to something I remember. I'm going back to where? Somehow I've gone back to a place that just knows such things, even though I've never experienced it or anything. Somehow I just know, right? That kind of objective recognition.
You mean like reality
response? Is your reality response, is your insights of your three cosmic intuitions. See, so like I said, there's an example, the same word in different places in the book, the RE prefix is used in the two ways we've been talking about tonight. You've got to think in context. What kind of an RE is this? Is this kind of an immediate subjective backness or againness? Or is this something more transcendent? Is this a bigger thing? And what they're saying is, religionists have been thinking on the lesser road about the word religion. They need to think on the greater road about the word religion. So that RE is not again or temporal or, you know, back to another place or something, but is transcendent of time and place. And it's back to eternity. That's the greater road recognition of the word religion, right? To play off of what we were just reading tonight. I mean, that's why, as they go forward in the rest of this paper, as we'll read about next week, the greater road offers these interesting possibilities. Because the more they go along the so-called greater road, Mahayana, the more they begin to bring in eternity to their scheme on the greater road. It starts out all very temporal, right? You know, with fig trees and stuff, right? And monastic contemplation. But as it goes forward on the greater road, more and more eternity begins to seep into the scheme. begins to filter down in from above. As you can, eternity can reach the greater road, can't reach the lesser road. Okay, that's just stuck in time. And so, sure enough, right? And not only does eternity begin to come into play, but eventually God comes into play. The other in eternity, right? It's just inescapable along the greater road that you will finally discover that the real meaning of the re prefix in religion is back to eternity. That's what they're discovering, those Mahayanists, over time.
In Islam, that says, and now the law, right now, the Russian, it means we come from eternity and we return back to eternity, or we come from God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what, when they die, they say that.
Right, know? Right.
So he went back to God. You know,
yes, yes. Yeah, see, that's the thing. They're, because of how some of the less Eastern, let's say it that way, religions have a little bit more connection to revelations about God, past revelations about God. It isn't as long a journey for them to think in terms of back to eternity or back to God, you know, with their RE prefix. But the E, you know, as we saw, we went east and we got really fuzzed out with Brahmanism. It was hard to find anything there. But, you know, once you get the greater road in play, like I was just saying, it leads you back to eternity. Eventually, took 2,000 years, say, right, or more, but eventually it starts to lead people back to eternity and back to a personalized God. That's the way this paper wraps up. So, I mean, all that seemed like it was a way off on a tangent, but see, notice, you know, no, I brought it right back because it's exactly what we're talking about. This struggle of like arguing about the RE prefix. Right in that fact is the whole struggle of the evolution of religion to try to transcend thinking about just time and to get yourself bound back to eternity. Have eternity be your starting point so that peace can be an actual fact in your life, right? Because you're not going to find peace in time. That's absurd, right? If nothing else, you know, time is now and now it's not. I mean, it changes always. Right? There's no peace in that incessant change. And only the changeless eternity can give you enduring peace. That's where you find enduring peace. Right? Okay, so we'll wrap things up next time with some more on the philosophic elements, and you know, if you flip forward, you see the God concept in Buddhism is the final section in this paper. That's where we end up. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.